Episode 20. It's the end of the book. To some people, Jesus did give a straight answer, and there are other, even more surprising occasions of ordinariness. Just after that wonderful incident in Emmaus, Luke tells another story about the resurrected Jesus in Luke 24:36-49. In this story, the question he asks is again priceless. Now picture the scene. The disciples are still frightened about the authorities, because if their leader could be arrested and executed, they too could be in serious trouble. But suddenly, Jesus himself appears among them. The dead man is there, and apparently alive. He tells them not to be afraid, and then tries to prove it's really him. And then, the text says, while they were still having trouble believing it in their joy and amazement, he asked them, got anything to eat around here? How's that for being disarmingly ordinary? Raised from the dead, and he's interested in what's cooking. Of course, it's not mere hunger that stands behind the question, because if they're thinking that his appearance might be that of a ghost, one of the best ways to counter that is by performing a bodily function like eating. In the Emmaus story, you'll remember, Jesus disappears from the house of the two disciples after taking the bread, blessing it, breaking it, and giving it out. The fact that Jesus did not stay long enough to eat anything in that story is rather extraordinary. Luke has an interest in showing that the resurrected Jesus had the kind of body that could eat. If the author of the gospel were just making stories up, there was ample opportunity to write Emmaus as a story in which Jesus ate. Oh well, perhaps the most significant display of ordinariness for our purposes comes earlier in the life of Jesus. There was a blind man begging on the road near Jericho. And hearing that Jesus was passing by, he called out to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asks. Now, doesn't this strike you as kind of a stupid thing to ask? If I'd been the blind guy, I know I would have squinted behind my dark glasses and brandished my white cane to punctuate my words. "What do you think I want, El Prophetismo? I'm blind." Now, all right. I know that probably very few blind people in the first century had white sticks, seeing eye dogs, and dark glasses, but I still find it difficult to believe that the man could walk or be led over to Jesus, Mark 10:50, Luke 18:40, without Jesus figuring out what was wrong with him. Jesus was perceptive enough to work out people's motivations before they spoke. He was perceptive enough to work out that he was dealing with a blind man. Throughout the book, though, it's become clear that Jesus was usually plying the questions he asked for purposes other than the acquisition of knowledge, and this is no exception. He wants the man to reply, but it isn't data that he desires. This odd question stands directly in line with the central question of the Gospels: who do you say that I am? Like the parables, the questions are not about the answer as much as they're about the answerer. The questions, like the parables, force the people with whom Jesus is conversing to take a stand, to make a decision. That's what he's after. He wants the blind man to declare himself. "Who touched me?" He wanted the woman to declare herself. "Who do you say that I am?" He wants his followers to declare themselves. Jesus' questions in the Gospels are like the handshaking that you hear when you connect a computer to a network using an old-fashioned modem. As my technically-minded friend Brett saw best to explain to me, that sound is the teensy little man that lives inside my modem asking and answering questions over the phone to the other little man who lives inside the computer at the other end. "I'm using this computer language. What language are you using? I can receive signals at this speed. How fast can you send it?" It's almost as if Jesus spoke modem language. He didn't always do miraculous, spooky stuff. He didn't always tell stories. He didn't even always ask questions. But in everything he did and said was this element of modem handshaking. I'm on this wavelength. What wavelength are you on? Now, something I've not mentioned up until now, really, is that the God of the Old Testament also appears as an asker of questions. There are questions to Moses, questions to kings, questions to prophets. The book of Jonah ends with God's question, a challenge to the prophet to change his attitude. To ancient Job's objections, God asks essentially, "Who do you think you are, potsherd face?" Job 38:4. He too used questions to get at matters of relationship rather than information. Back in the very first book of the Bible, just after the fall, when Adam and Eve try to escape from God's presence for the first time, God asks, "Where are you?" Genesis 3:9. Jesus, in his day, was asking that same question. Where are you? And we're now, at long last, in a position to answer my friend in the leather jacket, to evaluate Jesus. Was he the greatest teacher that ever lived, or a failure? In the first chapter, I tried to describe the greatest teacher in terms of ideal characteristics, and in some ways Jesus didn't fit. The curious thing is that when instead of abstract ideals, I try to think of the best teachers I've actually known, they also don't fit. Bottomless depths of knowledge? Totally persuasive in argument? Nah. The thing that links them all was energy, passion, a slightly different and infectious way of looking at things, but most of all, an active interest in their students. They were the ones who interacted, who asked, who forced you to think, but allowed you to think for yourself. Jesus, it seems, had no desire to become a great debater and convincer. What we said about the parables earlier was that they acted on fence sitters like a sharp stick, forcing you one way or the other. The surprise is that throughout his teaching, Jesus didn't exert undue pressure on you to land on his side of the fence. He was not in the convincing business. He was in the provoking business. His goal seems to have been to present people with opportunities to choose, perhaps even to force people to choose, and in this, he was incredibly successful. In fact, it seems he was only too successful. The Sadducees and Pharisees, as well as the disciples, were forced into decision and forced into action with terrible and tragic consequences. In some ways, he had to be put to death. But I think they are right who said about Jesus, "He asked for it," or "He brought it upon himself." He wanted people to choose. He refused to talk them into following him, refused to prove who or what he was. It's not because he felt that one answer was as good as another, but rather because an answer is not good unless it's a genuine answer. He's handshaking in order to open up lines of communication. Jesus once apparently said that he demanded, that people become like little children if they wanted to follow him. Matthew 18:3. Well, he became like a little child as well. Most children go through a very particular and peculiar questioning stage, during which they seem to ask the question, "Why?" over and over again. And they ask it about things they could not possibly have the least interest or comprehension of. Ask any father who's found himself embroiled in the discussion of the difference between nuclear fission and fusion while daubing little pink noses with white sunscreen cream. Why do children do this? The answer is very simple. They don't want the information. They don't want to talk about the issue. They just want to talk. They want the relationship. They are reveling in the fact that they can say something that makes you answer, that they can come up with a reply that works no matter what you say or how little of it they understood. If ever there was a good metaphor for the mortal human praying to the divine being, this is it. And our guess has to be that God enjoys the whole process as much as an earthly parent does. We are beginning to talk on the right wavelength. It is the first dabbling at genuine interaction. Jesus asks a lot of questions, but he doesn't ask primarily because he wants to acquire knowledge, nor does he ask to help people realize they already have knowledge. He asks to help people realize where they stand. He asks questions in order to give an occasion for a reply, in order to initiate a conversation. What Jesus wanted to know, what Jesus was dying to know, was this: why do you call me good? Who do you say that I am? Well, that's it. That's the whole book. It was called Jesus Asked, and the publisher, Zondervan, gave me permission to read you the whole thing. To get the other episodes, open iTunes, search for Genf, click on the picture. You can also get the MP3s from my website. Do a web search with the words Genf and podcast. If you had fun, why not buy some copies of the book from Amazon? That'll convince Zondervan they should do more of this stuff. The synthesizer background music was by William Fields at teamtechno.com, used through the Creative Commons licensing scheme. I'm also really grateful to Paul Johnson of the Duotones for this acoustic surf guitar music. Go say hello to him at pjmoto.com. Thanks for listening.